I've written a book entitled Leadership as an Identity, and I believe everyone will get a copy of that when we leave. You're going to be surprised by the first words that come out of my mouth. I am afraid that we as evangelicals and followers of Jesus are becoming a little bit too obsessed with leadership. One of my major concerns as we talk about leadership is that we somehow or another have so elevated leadership and people with the gift of leadership that we treat those who are leading as if they're better than. And it's a scary thing. You can't take glory or credit for something that's been given to you. And to be a leader is not a statement of your value. It's not a statement of your worth. It's not a statement of self-actualization. It's not a statement of significance. Not at all. Not at all. But having said that, one of the reasons why I wrote the book is because, you know, for years I taught this course up at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School as a visiting professor on leadership as an identity. And in fact, it was called something else, but that's what we came down to. And when I first started teaching this course, for years I've been reading everything I get my hands on leadership. When I first started teaching this course, I began to realize that so much that has been written about leadership, distinctively Christian leadership, was a little fast and loose with what really the Bible said about it. We made our own assumptions about it, that leaders plan, lead, organize, and control, or if you take the DISC test, they're high D's and high I's, or certain profiles or this kind of thing. And then we ran to the Bible and proof text that and snatched some verses out of context, and then we said that's what the Bible teaches about leadership. Well, that's not true. And so I decided to go back to the Bible and ask this one question as I read through the scriptures. What is it that every great man or woman of God, what is it that they had in common that God trusted with his assignments? Now, by the way, I use that expression, trusted with his assignments, that hints toward what I really believe the Bible teaches about leadership. What is it that they all had in common? And as I read through the scriptures, I came to some shocking conclusions. Number one, there's no such thing as a certain personality profile. You won't find it in the Bible. Now, I know we take our tests and we do it at our church with our staff and all this other kind of tests to see where people fit and all of this stuff. But the truth of the matter is there is no particular leadership profile in the Bible. You will not find it. It is not there. God has an amazing sense of humor. He has shy people, reticent people. He's got bombastic personalities. He's got people in between. And it will blow your mind. So you got to be careful of front-loading the scriptures with our own set of assumptions and making the Bible say what it doesn't say. The other thing that I found out is that there's no common background, no common pedigree, meaning that these people came from this and this leadership bent and profile was passed down from one generation. You won't find that at all there. Thirdly, there was no common experiences or education. God's like amazingly random. Yeah. Farmers, you got people born and raised in palaces, you got shepherds, you got all kinds, tax collectors, you got all kinds of people. So there's no blueprint that you can lay over that. But I did discover that as I went through the scriptures, that every great man or woman of God that God trusted with his assignments had these four things in common. Had these four things in common. And by the way, I want to say that these four things probably should be true of every Christian, but they're exponentially true of every person that God trusts with his assignments. And before I get to those four things, let me just say a word about the reason why I use the word assignment. In the Bible, and we're going to get back to this when I discuss the third thing that they all had in common. In the Bible, leadership has categorically no meaning apart from what needs to be done. That's the reason why we got to take ego from leadership. You got to take all that stuff from leadership. It's not a statement. The only reason why you have leadership is because there's an assignment that has to be done. That's the only reason why you have leaders. You don't have leaders because they've climbed up the org chart and this kind of thing, and they, quote, paid their dues, and, you know, they wear the nicer clothes and got a bigger office and they got more education. And, you know, that's, the Bible knows nothing about that. The only reason why there's leadership in the kingdom is because there's something to be stewarded. That's the only reason why there's leadership in the kingdom. And that's the reason why I'm a little bit afraid of us a la carting leadership in our discussions and how we talk about it as if it's a place at which we need to arrive. That's not what the Bible teaches. And you're going to say, well, Crawford, aren't there positions of leadership? I'm going to get to that later on when I talk about the third characteristic. Yes, there are positions, but the positions exist for the task that needs to be performed. It's all defined by task, all defined by what needs to be done. So when I say that God trusts with his assignments, that's what I mean by leadership. What do these men and women have in common? Every great man or woman of God, that God has trusted with his assignments, had these four things in common. And I'm almost embarrassed to give them to you because you can figure them out all by yourself. The first one is brokenness. The first one is brokenness. Listen to me. God never, ever, ever uses anything that comes to him together. Hate to say it. God is not using you because you have an MBA from Kennesaw, from Georgia, or from Vanderbilt, or from Harvard. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not underselling education. But the truth of the matter is, God never trusts his assignments with people who think that they are competent. God never trusts his assignments to people who think that they paid their dues. Brokenness is a part of what God does. So everything that God uses over the long haul, he breaks it and reshapes it. And the reason why brokenness is so important is because what is done in human history, if it has a signature over the supernatural, it has to be all about the glory of God. God does not share the stage. It's not in the joint billing. It's not you and Jesus. It's not you and God. It's not Crawford and God. Fellowship Bible Church is not Crawford's gig or platform. It's not about me. It's not the shopping of my abilities and my gifts. It's not about any of that. It's all about the glory of God. And so he breaks his servants so that he might give them a holy handicap that will cause them to constantly depend upon him. So the spotlight is always on him. That forever, whatever you do, it's always about God. Always. I can give you all kinds of illustrations, but we don't have all night, so I'll just pick on Moses. There's been a lot of mispreaching about Moses and his leadership. Some have made the dastardly assertion that because, you know, Moses, he was qualified to lead because he spent those years in the palace and this kind of thing. Oh, bull feathers, that's not true. That's categorically not true. What does God do? Moses is spending 40 years on the backside of the desert looking at the south side of sheep. Now check it out. I'm not trying to be profane here, but listen, just, you know, the sense of the Bible. Homeboy's out there in the wilderness, and he comes in Exodus 3. He sees this brush fire, this burning bush. And by the way, that wasn't unusual because in that region of the world, there are brush fires all the time. The problem was is that the bush wasn't burning up. And he encounters God. God says, take off his shoes, for you're ready now. Oh, you're ready now. And check this out. By the time we find Moses, with every degree of intellectual honesty and integrity, you must conclude, Moses had zero self-esteem. You read Exodus 3. Please read Exodus 3 and 4. This conversation that he's having with God, now mind you, I don't want to get too hard on Brother Moses, but I got to tell you something. If God is speaking to me from a burning bush, I ain't going to be arguing with him, all right? You know what I'm saying? It's just like, I can do whatever you say I can do, I guess. But Moses is having this argument with the bush, with God. He's saying, God, I tried that before. I'm out here in the wilderness. That's how I got here. Remember? You're omniscient. You know all things. I'm here. Hello? God says, and he's given all these excuses. And finally, the tone of Exodus 4, you just feel the emotional tone. And God's getting a little ticked with Moses, isn't he? said, all right, Moses, what's that you have in your hand? He said, his staff have been using this to get the sheep out of bed. He said, throw it on the ground. It becomes a serpent. Pick it up again. It becomes a staff. Let me see hand. Yeah, 80-year-old hand, varicose veins. Look at that thing there. Yeah, put it in your chest. Pull it out. Leprous. Put it back in. Whole. What was God's point? God's point was this. I don't use what you bring to the table anyway. I use what you surrender to me. Understand that? This ain't about you to begin with. You don't ever have enough to do what I've called you to do. That's the point. You don't have the resource. That's the point. You don't have the ability. That's the point. So brokenness is buttressed by two things. What I call proactive surrender. That's what we just talked about there. And the second thing that brokenness is buttressed by is the acute awareness of our own personal sinfulness. Psalm 51, David's confession and repentance after that horrendous sin with Bathsheba. And he is broken. He's broken. And by the way, brokenness is not an unhealthy thing. Brokenness is not woundedness. Woundedness is unhealthy. If you're wounded, don't get in a position of leadership or service. Take care of the wound. Wounded people hurt people. Wounded people use positions of leadership as a platform for their own personal therapy. Wounded people end up manipulating people. Wounded people will abuse people because hurt people. So you got to kind of take, brokenness is not woundedness. Brokenness has to do with the idea that I am forever aware of my God neediness. Brokenness is a permanent sense of God neediness, that I need him every second. And so when I say an acute awareness of our sinfulness, listen to me closely. There's far too much arrogance in ministry these days and far too much self-confidence, far too much trusting in your own ability, far too much thinking that you're not capable of hurting the heart of God. I find it's with those of us who don't do the same sins like we used to before. We actually think because God used us that there's some little personal, you know, position that I have with him that I get a little extra perks when it comes to my sanctification. We must always remember there's not a one of us in here that cannot do the most damnable, despicable, awful things you can imagine. And don't you ever say what you would not do. Don't you ever say that. You ever let cross your mouth what you would not do. And that's what brokenness is. God wants to trust his assignments with people that understand that they're a quarter inch away from hurting his heart in any given moment. And it's in that proactive neediness that he says, Crawford, I can trust you. I'm going to give you visibility because I know it's not going to mess with your head. I'm going to give you recognition because I know that that's not going to be another line on your resume. I'm going to give you responsibility, and I'm going to let people know about you, okay? Because I know you're not going to prostitute the platform. You know who you are, and you remember the pain. You remember your woodshed experiences. You know what that's all about. So I'm going to trust you with it. By the way, I'd say this to you, as your churches grow and the things get more complicated, one of the things I've learned to ask younger leaders that I bring on board is this. I want to know about your failures, and I want to know about those moments in which you were crushed. Tell me. And if they don't have any, they're not ready for that position. We lead with a limp. We lead with a limp, not with some superficial swag. We lead with a limp. The first thing that every great man or woman God had in common that God trusted with his assignments. Hate to say it, I'm not saying that incompetence is, you should not celebrate incompetence. I'm not saying that. The very first thing they all had in common was brokenness. Second thing that every great man or woman of God had in common that God trusted with his assignments is that they were marked, number two, by what I call uncommon communion. Now, I got to explain this one a little bit here. Uncommon communion. What I mean by that, I'm not just talking about your personal devotional life, your quiet time. And I'm just talking about that. You see, God's assignments are marked by a gap. Follow me. I know you've had a long day, but follow me here. Listen to me. God's assignments are always marked by a gap. They're always marked by a gap. If there's not a gap between what needs to be done and what you have, then God's probably not in it. He's probably not in it. Because, you see, God uses his assignments, the assignments that he gives to leaders, he uses that in the leader's life to make the leader become the destination at which he wants to tell others to arrive. In other words, all leadership in the Bible is prophetic. Leadership is prophetic, meaning that the leader is the portrait of the desired destination at which others need to arrive. That's the reason why in the Bible, character, being is everything. Everything. Because we as leaders have to pay the price to be the portrait of the desired destination at which the people follow. Any other leadership is disingenuous. It's hypocritical. So in the process of doing something, you have to become something. So God creates the gap. I don't have what I need. But you have who you need. You see, what I'm trying to say is this. Look. One of the reasons why leaders burn out, one of the reasons why they burn out is because they look at God's assignments differently. I don't necessarily think that they may be doing the wrong stuff. I just think that they look at it differently. They view what God has called them to as a competitor rather than a pathway back to the heart of God. If I view my ministry as a competition between me and Karen or my kids or my grandkids or these other priorities that I have, then my ministry is going to be the enemy. However, if I view the assignment that God has given to me as a means by and through which I look more like him and I'm called into his presence, then that becomes part of my sanctifying process. The calling energizes me. The calling drives me to be more like him. My brother's talked about Tim Cash. I love old Timmy. He's a great guy. Timmy told our youngest son was a phenomenal baseball player. It was my early retirement program, and then God called him to ministry. Somebody got to make money in my household. My youngest daughter's a doctor, so maybe with Obamacare, that may not happen. Oh, excuse me, I hope that wasn't. That was not nice. A little ADD working up in here. It's not. Please. Timmy told me this story. He told me this story about this guy that bounced along the minor leagues all these years. And, you know, baseball is a humbling thing. You can be a great ball player, but you get in one of these organizations, farm systems that's deep in your position, and you can get buried and lost and this kind of thing. And he was telling this buddy of his that just bounced around in the minor leagues. And if you have made it to the show by the time you're 25, 26 years old in baseball, that's old. And so this buddy of his, you know, he was approaching 30 and went over, played in Japan and came back. And this guy finally got the call up. And the second week he was in the majors, he had this injury that ended his career. And Timmy said to him, he said, "Man, how do you feel about that, man? I'm so sorry that this happened to you." And he said, "Tim, don't feel sorry for me." He said, "Why?" He said, "Because I became a believer those last few years that I was in the minor leagues. God worked in my heart and life. And he used this line, and on my way to doing something, I became somebody." Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? So on your way to doing something, you got to become something. And God gives us these gaps, these assignments. Yeah, we're running out of time here, but I could pick on Moses again. The tent of meeting, Moses had this tent of meeting. You can read it yourself over in Exodus 33. He had this tent of meeting, and it's an amazing portrait. Here's a man that's given the assignment of leading 2.5 million Israelites out of the land of Egypt into the promised land. I mean, you know, we look at these stories in the rearview mirror and we don't feel the enormity of what he had to do. And every day it says that he would go outside the camp with this tent and he would pitch this tent. His young dude named Joshua would follow him. And Moses would get away from the distraction and he would pitch this tent and he would go inside the tent and the presence of God would be there. Now, I don't exactly know what he prayed, but I kind of know what he prayed. And I don't mean this to be funny, but I think Moses went in there, and as is typical with God and his leaders, he a la carte the assignments. He doesn't give you the whole piece. And Moses goes into that tent, and I guarantee you, he fell on his face and said, God, help me. Help me. Help me. I don't know what to do. Will you help me? Will you show me? And God would show him. 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 There's never a moment in a leader's life where it's okay to not depend upon God. Never a moment. Never. Ever. Ever. You ought to be scared to death if you're not trusting God for something. God bridges the gap. That's what I call uncommon communion. So let me just summarize that. By uncommon communion, the leader is called by God to tap into the heart of God to get the resources from God to accomplish what God has called them to do, and thus bridging the gap. It's my next book I'm writing on that. The title is Bridging the Gap. But that's what we're called to do. So every great man and woman of God that God's entrusted with his assignments, and this is what I'm saying. When you say you want to be a Christian leader, this ain't no gig. It's not a game. Not a game. Not a hobby. My little volunteer stuff I'm doing for Jesus. Really? Really? Jesus, so nice of you, Crawford. Yeah. Marked by brokenness, marked by uncommon communion. And number three, every great man or woman of God that God's trusted with his assignments that have left a mark on history for the glory of God. And I want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to this. They were characterized, they were characterized by servanthood as an identity and not as a strategy. Okay? I got to tell you, one of the things that bothers me a little bit is that if you read any article on leadership, go to any seminar on leadership or workshop on leadership or book on leadership, pretty soon they're going to drop the servant leadership deal there. But don't be fooled so much by that, because what a lot of people mean by that is not necessarily what we mean by that. In other words, there's a little bit of too much quid pro quo. You know what I mean? A little bit too much I scratch your back, you scratch mine. And in the Bible, servant leadership is not used as a strategy, meaning to affect a bottom line or to affect an outcome. You know, for example, if you give looking for something in return, you have not given. Technically, you've invested. In the Bible, servant leadership is not about investing. You serve out of an identity. You serve because you are servant. You're not looking for something in return. You're not looking for this, and you're not looking for the story. Now, don't get me wrong. Recognition is very important. I just preached on that yesterday. Recognition in the Bible is very important. What you guys did tonight is also very right. We should recognize people, but we shouldn't serve for recognition. That's what I'm saying. Recognition is right, but you shouldn't serve for recognition. The reason why we applauded these folks is because they didn't serve for that. They did it because of the nobility of the vision, and that was right. But in the Bible, you serve because you are a servant. That's the reason why I say, yeah. In the Bible, leadership is never, ever, 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 ever spoken of as a position. So you say, well, wait a minute, Crawford, there's positions. Yes, they're positions of leadership, but positions in the Bible are given for a platform to serve. Not because you're entitled. The position is an expression of trust. I'm trusting that you're going to use this to serve. That's the reason why the greatest leaders are always those who are doing something. They're the people who are serving. And you recognize them because they're serving. You see, greatness finds faithful people. Positions find servants. That's one of the main reasons why 95% of the time, if someone comes to me and they're asking for a position of leadership, 95% of the time I say no. And the reason why I say no is because if you're campaigning for that, I'm wondering if you've taken care of some personal significance issues. What do you want that for? What do you want it for? Oh, there are all kinds of texts that we could go to. He just shared the ultimate text is the example of Jesus in John 13. What a powerful passage. Feel the text here, John 13, 14, 15, and 16, just before he's going to die. If you know anything about a cultural milieu or the traditions of the time, you understand the drama here. Here you have the Lord of history. They come into this household, and one of the things you did back then, one of the customs of the time, if somebody showed up at your house, a visitor, because it was hot and dusty and you walked a long way, just like we in the middle of, you know, July and August, somebody comes visit us, we give them a big, tall glass of nice, iced, sweet tea, right? We give it to them. It's refreshing. Well, back then, what you did was that you invited them to eat in your home. You washed their feet. You wash their feet for two reasons. One, to soothe their feet, to clean it up and, you know, to refresh them. The other one was a practical reason. You don't want somebody sticking their dirty dogs in your, you know, lamb kebabs while you're eating, man. Never mind, that's another little stream of consciousness here. You didn't do that. But, you know, my research indicates that was the job of the lowliest of all the servants. You're a household of some substance. You didn't. The host didn't do that. You didn't do that. So don't get too hard on Peter. And Peter got upset. Don't do that, Jesus. Don't do that. That's beneath you. No, don't do that. And Jesus said in so many words to Peter, hey, buddy, shut up. I'm going to teach you a lesson in leadership that I don't ever want you to forget. If you're leading, nobody should outserve you. Everybody that you're responsible for, they ought to know that there's nothing you will ever ask them to do that either you have not done or you're not willing to do yourself. Ever. I don't get a pass because I'm Dr. Loritz. I don't get a pass because people listen to me on the radio and follow me on Twitter. What do you have that hasn't been given to you? What do you have? God took me. My great-grandfather was a slave. Couldn't read or write. I ain't got a blasted thing that hasn't been given to me. I stand on the shoulders of praying people. Folks that didn't have 2 cents to rub together. Entitlement will kill your ministry. You hear me? You hear me? My staff knows that I will go off on them if they ever say words like, I paid my dues. Shut up, son. You ain't paid your dues as long as you're on this side of the dirt. Don't be talking about you paid your dues. Really? I've got my degree. You're still unemployed, so what? What's up with that? I'm sorry about that. Just, you know, the little head cases that come kind of floating around. I can't do that. You know what I mean? It's just so like, sometimes I think Jesus leans over the banister of heaven and says, you know, there's only three members of the Trinity, not four, is there? It's just like, he's acting like he belongs up here. There's another moving account, and I will go, 2 Samuel 16 through 19. David is fleeing for his life. His son Absalom has orchestrated this massive coup d'etat. And one of the reasons why David was overthrown, he was a terrible father. Despite his greatness, David was a terrible daddy. That incestuous situation with Tamar and his own son Absalom said, I'm going to get you. And so David is leaving with his old wilderness buddies. I mean, these dudes, David's an old dude by now. He's leaving Jerusalem. Jerusalem's in the rearview mirror of the chariot. And he comes, and across this ridge comes this dude named Shimei. You remember the story? Shimei comes, and he's cussing David. I mean, he's cussing him. It's kind of humorous when you think about it. And so, I think Abishai, Joab, one of his David's old wilderness coins, said, should I go over and cut off the head of this dead dog? I mean, he preaches his eulogy before. He said, look, I can take care of this right now. He doesn't need to be cussing. And listen to what David said. This is what made him great. David said, well, leave him alone. Leave him alone. Maybe I need to hear this. In context, what he's saying is, well, maybe I got too full of myself. And maybe this is what this is all about. And maybe God just wants to knock me down a few notches. And you might say, well, Crawford, perhaps, David was distraught. After all, his son wants to kill him. Jerusalem is there, and he's not thinking right. Well, if you go over to chapter 19, when he's reinstalled as king, and Shimei, the same dude that cussed him, now he needs adult diapers, okay? He's come back in town, and he's going, oh, my word. And again, David's wilderness, but I said, look, David, you can't allow this dude to do this to you. I mean, you're the king now. You need to take care of him. Go kill him. And listen to what David said. Love it. He said, what have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah? Don't you know that I know that I'm the king? Great leaders never use power for their personal gain. Never operate from power. I didn't say they didn't use power, but it's never personal. Never personal. Great leaders understand they don't have to beat people up. I was given this platform to love and to serve, and I'm going to use this platform to love and to serve. The final thing, every great man or woman of God that God's trusted with his assignments, that's made a mark in history, they are characterized, number one, by brokenness. God never uses anything that comes to him together. Proactive surrender. Secondly, uncommon communion. That is, they realize that there's a gap between where they are and what needs to take place. So they tapped into the heart of God to get that. Number three, servanthood as an identity, not as a strategy. But I serve. Whether there's anything back, any recognition whatsoever, I do it. Because it's a privilege. And the fourth one is this. Every great man or woman of God that God's trusted with his assignments, they were characterized by radical, immediate obedience. They did not view the will of God as a series of options that they could check off, say yes to or no to, I like this, I don't like this. It wasn't a career path. It wasn't a job. It wasn't something that they had control over. They viewed God's assignments. And by the way, when people challenge you to do something, I hope you don't say yes immediately. When people challenge you to do something, fall on your knees. Is this from the Lord? Is this from God? Does God want me to do this? And sometimes things are obvious, but does God want me to do this? And this is where I differ with some people in discussions about the will of God. I am so concerned in our desire to have an attractive Christianity, we're despiritualizing the very nature of what we're all about. Look, the Church of Jesus Christ is not the Kiwanis Club, okay? You know what I'm saying? This is not some charitable entity. It's not some civic organization. The Church of Jesus Christ runs by transcendent kingdom principles that are supernatural. There's something that God wants done in human history, and you cannot measure all of vision. And be very careful in your vision discussions and in your planning meeting. If you can measure it, if you can quantify it, if you can figure it out in this lifetime, probably is not of God, because there are things that's being passed on from one generation to the next that God is veiling in this generation. That's Hebrews chapter 11. And we stand on the shoulders. There are prayers that are being prayed in this generation where God says, yes, that's a vision, but you're not going to see it. You need to provide the portrait of dependence upon me and of perseverance. And I'm going to allow you to go through, and I say this in the appropriate sense, to go through hell. I'm going to allow you not to see the fruit of what you're believing me for. Because I want a future generation to look back and see your perseverance and their gratitude in that generation. In that generation, the holy fertilizer that was spread in your generation will produce that crop. So we need to be very careful about measurables, and we get a little full of ourselves. Size and measurements and this kind of thing. No. We obey him because of the nobility of the voice of God. Did you hear me? Because of the nobility of the voice of God. So we do it. And we would rather die than disobey him. And listen to me, as a leader, you don't have to be successful. Success is a relative term, but you do have to be obedient. You don't have to be stroked and be popular. But if God's told you to do something, you don't quit until he says quit. Where do you get that from? Well, I could go almost any place, but my time is really up here. Acts chapter 13. Let's just pick on David again. Acts 13. This is Paul's famous eulogy of David. We'll pick it up in verse 22. He's really contrasting the motivation of David with that of Saul. And he says in verse 22, and when he, meaning God, had removed him, meaning Saul, he raised up David to be their king, of whom he testified and said, I love it. I have found in David, the son of Jesse, a man after my heart who will do all my will. In the Greek text, the word will is plural. Will do all my wills as in assignments. Isn't it a wonderful thing for God to be able to say, I can trust you. I know that no matter what happens, you're going to do everything I tell you to do. You're going to keep after it. You're not going to quit. You're going to keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. Listen to me. Faithfulness is underrated. Greatness never happens to people when they pursue greatness. Greatness is a byproduct of doing what's in front of you, 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 what's in front of you. Just do it. God said, do it, I'll do it. God said, be there, I'll be there. Just do it. And so that famous last line in verse 36, for David, after he had served the purpose, I love the play on words, all those wills weaving the tapestry of God's purpose for David's life, after he had served the purpose of God in his own generation, fell asleep and was laid with his fathers and saw corruption. I've got four adult children. They love Jesus. I've got two sons who are pastors. And on weekends, particularly early Sunday mornings, I can't think about that so much because I begin to tear up and I think that all three of us are standing and preaching the book. I got 8 grandkids. 7 of the 8 have given their heart to Jesus. We're working on 2-year-old Addison. She's just getting this potty training thing down yet. You know, my wife went up there to help. I got a little aside here. This is like my youngest daughter and her husband, they're both physicians. They're both doctors, and they're in residence up in Michigan, and they work them like Hebrew slaves. I mean, it's terrible what they do. So poor Addison, you know, a little nanny situation, this kind of thing. And so the schedule is like all over the place. And so, you know, so my youngest daughter called my wife, Karen, this is about a month ago. I said, "Mom, can you come up here and help me potty train Addison?" So I know the answer is yes. I mean, you know, like I'm going to be with my daughter. How are you getting there? You're paying for it. Okay. Yes, ma'am. So I'm getting all these texts back, you know, with pictures of Addison on the potty. I'm saying, "Karen, what are you sending me this for?" And they're like, "Yay!" I'm going, "Touchdown." All right, so, you know. What I'm trying to say right now, this season in my life, I wish I had embraced this in my heart when I was 25, 30, and 35 years old. I'm not obsessed about gifts or abilities or position. I just want to make sure that I'm doing everything God told me to do. That's all I want. That's all I want. That's all I want for my kids. That you do what he said to do. Don't make this leadership thing harder than it was intended to be. Don't make it more scientific and complicated than it was intended to be. Do what's in front of you. Pray about what you're challenged to do. Show up. Give God the glory. And leave the results to him. Thank you very much.